This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Tamika Artis, filling in today for Michael Monks. The new year will bring a new mayor to Cincinnati, and right now, the mayor-elect's new administration is starting to take shape. Aftab Purival announcing this week his pick for vice mayor. He also unveiled his transition team. Joining Cincinnati Edition with more on these announcements is WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Welcome, Becca.
Hello, thanks for having me.
And you can join our conversation by calling us at 513-419-7100 or emailing us at talk@wvxu.org. Becca, first off, let's begin by talking about what does it say about the city soon-to-be mayor that he even put together a transition team?
Well, there's a couple of new things about this. It's not very common for a transition team or really a transition effort, this kind of focused and intentional and proactive. But a big part of that is just how much time Mayor-elect Purival has between winning the election and taking office. Previously, mayors would take office at the beginning of December, really just a month or even sometimes just 3 weeks after the election. Whereas Purival has really 2 months to kind of get things together and really make a plan for how to hit the ground running in January. So I think that's really the biggest difference, is just the opportunity to have a lot of time for planning and preparation.
So let's discuss the chosen, if you will, and perhaps some insight into what this says about the priorities of his administration moving forward. We know that one member of the transition team includes a former mayor of Cincinnati. Let's talk about the team.
That's right. Former Mayor Mark Mallory, who was at City Hall from 2005 to 2013. An interesting thing that they even pointed out at the press conference is before Purival, the only other person who had been elected mayor without first serving on city council was Mayor Mallory. So they have that in common, coming in with really a fresh perspective, not having spent time in the City Hall politics that are there. So I think that is interesting. The other two co-chairs of this transition team are Michael Fisher, who is the retiring president and CEO of Children's Hospital. He got a lot of ties with the business community, and they highlighted how important that's going to be in really keeping the economy strong and the tax base strong so that Purival can hopefully accomplish some of his really ambitious plans. And then lastly, Stephanie Jones, she's an attorney from here in Cincinnati, has been an advisor to Presidents Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. She also leads a civil rights nonprofit focused on civil rights law and empowering Black attorneys called the Call to Justice Foundation. And she really highlighted Purival's focus on racial equity, which he does say is a kind of the common thread in all of his policy priorities.
And so we have a former mayor, a healthcare professional, and also a civil rights leader. Let's talk about some of the issues that the incoming mayor ran on and the priorities as you see and as he assembles this transition team.
Yeah, so Purival really ran on this idea that he's got a plan for everything. We heard it a lot at the debates and a lot of interviews. He's got a plan. His four primary policy plans are affordable housing, economic recovery, climate change, and criminal justice / public safety. There's a lot in these plans in terms of things that he actually wants to accomplish. And it's kind of intention, or what he says is intention with the transition team, is for them to turn these plans into actionable items. So drafting legislation, working with the incoming council, who are also mostly new, on what to prioritize first. We did ask for, you know, some specifics on what are some of the first things we'll see in terms of legislation or policy changes in the first 100 days. We don't have those specifics yet, but presumably that's what the transition team is working on now.
All right. So all of that remains to be seen. So how common is it for an incoming mayor to even have a transition team?
It's not very common. You know, as I said, usually it was a much shorter period of time between the election and taking office. Mayor Cranley did not have a transition team. Former Mayor Mallory, who is on this transition team, said it's not common. It's certainly not something that he's seen. So it will be an interesting process for sure.
So how involved has Mayor Cranley been in this transition, and has he been cooperative?
Purival says he's been very cooperative and very proactive, that outgoing Mayor Cranley reached out to Purival to set up that first meeting. They met just the day after the election, before the results have even been certified. And Pureville says they have a standing weekly meeting to meet every single week. Cranley has told me he's committed to making it the smoothest possible transition, and he wants to make sure that city administration, city government doesn't have any disruptions as the transition takes place.
So is there anything about the transition team that was assembled that surprised you, either the level of experience or who was not included?
No real surprises for me, although I think maybe important to note, I'm pretty new to the politics scene here. And so perhaps some people who've had a longer perspective would have some surprises there. You know, I think former Mayor Mark Mallory has had a close relationship with Pureville for a long time. And I do think the kind of choice of Michael Fisher of Children's Hospital is an interesting one. And they did make a point to talk about how important that business relationship is going to be. And those are sometimes things that are placed at odds at City Hall, you know, talking about what's good for business versus what's good for residents. And some folks saying that those are sometimes contradictory. And so that will be, I think, an interesting thing to keep an eye on.
So what can you tell us about how often the co-chairs are meeting? And I know you said that you haven't gotten a whole lot of information or insight into what's being discussed, but what do we know about these meetings? How long are they? How often? What kinds of things might be being discussed?
Those are things we don't know a lot about. We know that the transition team is meeting with the incoming council members, and they're meeting with city manager Paula Boggs-Muthing, as well as department heads. And again, kind of working on the plan for those first 100 days and what they're going to do first. But, you know, we don't have a lot of detail about what specifically that looks like. Someone did ask Pureville, you know, how long this transition team would be in place. He kind of jokingly said their jobs will never be done, that he hopes that they will continue to be advisors for him as he is in office for the full term. And that it's something that he hopes that they will continue to be, you know, helping him shape his policies and accomplish what he hopes to accomplish.
And also on this team, or at least in some part, is an executive from P&G. Tell us about that.
So this was an interesting name that we've heard more recently at City Hall. It's Harry Kandis, a former P&G executive. He's consulted with the city in the past. Most recently, he basically led the process of evaluating the city manager, Paula Boggs-Muthing, and really focused on, he actually helped draft the creation of this evaluation process a few years ago, and it was just used for the first time a couple months ago for Paula Boggs-Muthing. And so he definitely has an understanding of the inner workings of City Hall. And I think, Pureville says he is definitely a strategic planner. And I think he is hoping to have someone kind of looking at it from a broader view and helping make those decisions.
So in addition to the transition team, Jan Michelle Lemon Kearney has been selected as vice mayor. She's quickly become quite popular in Cincinnati with voters. And Pureville had some glowing reviews about her as far as the role that she will play in moving his agenda forward. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I think Jan Michelle Lemon Kearney is the natural choice. I think it's the one that folks expected. She did win the most votes of all nine council members coming in on the new council. And it was her first election, but as you said, she's become very popular. She was chair of the neighborhoods committee, and more than any other committee this year, really took that committee out into the communities and met with several neighborhoods. And I think that is something that has endeared her to voters. And as you said, someone who's very popular, and I think will be a leader on council as they try to push their priorities forward.
What exactly is the role of the vice mayor, and does she take over for the mayor if he's not able to serve for some reason?
Yeah, so strategically, just day to day, there are times when the mayor is not able to attend a council meeting. And so the person that usually presides over council and sets the calendar, et cetera, if that person can't be there, the vice mayor will step in and serve in that role. But yes, as you said, if Mayor-elect Pureville is unable to serve, it resigns, or for any reason is incapacitated, Lemon Kearney would step in and serve as mayor in that case.
And what else can you tell us about her qualifications, her background, and some of the issues that she plans to champion, some of the things like we've talked about she's already been doing?
Yeah. So in terms of qualifications, Carol joked that, you know, she's a triple Ivy League graduate and that his Asian mother would be very proud of her. She definitely has strong credentials in terms of education and is also a lifelong Cincinnatian and has strong ties to the community here. Lemon Kearney also highlighted this focus on racial equity, that this is, you know, with all of the policies going forward, and she has talked a lot about affordable housing as an example, but that for all of these priorities, she is also focused on this idea of racial equity and making that a focus and a spotlight in all of these policies.
As far as racial equity and racial justice, when you take a look at this transition team and the vice mayor as well, it looks like diversity is the first thing that comes to mind. How important is that for this new administration moving forward?
It seems to be very important. I mean, Pierville ran on, you know, kind of the one word I think he would sum up his campaign on was equity. You know, maybe in close proximity to that would be change. And I think he has really tried to make this a huge priority. He mentioned, you know, in the announcement of the vice mayor decision, he brought up again this tax abatement concern. And this is a lawsuit filed against the city saying that residential tax abatements are disenfranchise minority citizens of the city. And he's mentioned this a few times and is definitely committed to making that something, making it a change. Those are discussions already happening at City Hall. There's a review underway and some suggestions to how to change that residential tax abatement process. But it's certainly something that Pierville is hoping to highlight and make very public and say that he is focused on making changes in that area.
And speaking of tax abatements, we know that the Hamilton County Commission, it looks like property taxes won't be getting the full tax rebate that they were promised back in 1996 when voters passed the sales tax to build the stadiums on the riverfront. What is the latest? What do we know?
So that's right. And Hamilton County property owners, homeowners haven't gotten that full promised tax abatement in a very long time. The last time was 2017. Before that, the last time was 2011. And so it's not been consistent. So basically, the administration of the county is recommending $8.5 million for rebates. And that's about $28 per $100,000 of home value. And that is going to vary based on, you know, the tax district that a Hamilton County resident lives in. So it is a rebate, but it's also a little bit higher than the rebate that was offered last year, which was pretty low, considering lots of budget concerns about the pandemic. So higher than last year, but not as high as promised.
And so with the little bit of time that we have left here, where do the county commissioners come down on this 10% rebate issue? And does it have their support?
It seems likely that this the 10% rebate that you mentioned is likely to pass, and that's very likely to be what happens for this year. But all the commissioners, you know, have said basically they would love to give the 30%, and that it's just very difficult the way that this sales deal was passed, the way that the stadium deal is written. They don't have a lot of flexibility. Basically, if they use 30% of the revenue for property tax rebates, that they wouldn't be able to afford to pay for all of the other things that they are obligated, legally obligated to pay for, and that it really could affect the basic services of the county if they couldn't pay for all of those things, like the sheriff's department, for example. So, you know, I think the commissioners really are just asking homeowners to kind of consider, we'd like to give you as much as we can. We're trying to raise it each and every year, but they say we're really limited and we can't go higher than this.
All right, Becca, thank you so much for joining us and for giving us your insights.
Thank you, Tamika. Have a great day.
You too. Well, hospitals are doing it. Some colleges are doing it. And President Biden has done it with a mandate on businesses with 100 or more employees. Now the Cincinnati Public School District is considering it for students. We're talking about a vaccine mandate. So how do parents feel? WVXU reporter Corey Sharber is here with their reaction. Hi, Corey.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going great. So this proposed vaccine mandate for CPS students, tell us how parents responded, how was the survey conducted, and how many parents participated?
Well, CPS sent out a survey to parents asking if they would be supportive of of a proposed COVID-19 vaccine mandate for students. And the results show that 66% of the parents who responded do not support the mandate. And to be more specific, the survey went to over 22,000 families across all schools in the district, and CPS received roughly more than 6,000 responses. So it was based on a response rate of just below 27%.
So what can you tell us about how the survey was conducted exactly? Were they open-ended questions? Explain to us the survey and how that took place.
Well, the survey itself, the survey was sent out on November 4th. They did the survey via, let me get my notes here. It was, I believe it was sent digitally to all the families throughout the district. Some of the responses, I know that yesterday when I was watching the Policy and Equity Committee meeting, they, some of the board members were kind of voiced frustrations about how the question was asked, saying that it was kind of made the situation more black and white. Therefore, that may have affected the survey in some sort of way.
And there was some analysis of Title I schools, which have a higher percentage of low-income students versus non-Title I schools. And how did those parents respond? And what can you tell us about anything that can be inferred from those responses?
Well, it says here that a little less than 52% of non-Title I families opposed the student vaccine mandate. But then greater than more than 76% of Title I families oppose the mandate. This more or less signals, as you could probably already imagine, that a majority of parents are not for this. The board is also taking this into account as well. Board member Eve Bolden during the meeting earlier this week and during yesterday's Policy and Equity Committee meeting basically said that, you know, it's not the board's role to make this decision for the families, and are hoping to do more to facilitate, you know, information about vaccines to encourage children to get vaccinated. But it's really not in their domain to force this amongst the students.
Yes. And so discussions about the student vaccine policies began shortly after one was approved for employees and co-located partners. Describe the initial policy draft as it pertains to students and as it stands now.
For students, the policy, the drafted policy is very similar to the mandate in place for employees. Essentially means that all vaccine eligible students would have to get a COVID-19 vaccine that's received full approval from the FDA. And as we know, the Pfizer vaccine has only been approved for people ages 16 and up. So that essentially means anyone within CPS that's 16 or older that goes there would have to get the vaccine, which means that below that, it wouldn't really be enforced evenly throughout all of the schools in the district.
And so, as you've been talking here, it seems to me that the vast majority of parents and school board members seem to believe that this should be a personal choice. But COVID has obviously been quite disruptive to all of our lives and the education of our children. How much are school leaders and parents willing to compromise, and what does a compromise look like?
Right now, it seems like at this time, they're more, I think, with the employee mandate in place, that they had to do that in order to ensure that staff weren't getting sick. The reason schools shut down went to remote learning last year is because so many staff members were getting sick. And so the vaccine mandate had to be implemented to ensure that they could keep schools running as they're going on. So as far as a compromise, it seems like the compromise is to sort of keep things the way they are with the employee vaccine mandate, with the mask mandate within CPS schools for students, and then just encourage more students to get vaccinated as we go on.
Okay. Again, we are talking with WVXU reporter Corey Sharber, who covers education for the city of Cincinnati. Moving on now, we are seeing the latest development in the rift between CPS and Metro. Metro has announced that it is done busing Cincinnati public school students at the end of the school year. Corey, what is going on?
So effective June 30th, 2022, the contract between Metro and Cincinnati Public Schools will end. CPS has been accepting bids from private transportation providers in order to, to provide yellow buses and so on and so forth. When they opened up their request for proposals from private providers, it also alerted Metro to it as well. Metro cannot submit a bid because if they were to do that, they would be violating federal regulations, which essentially means that the second they, it seems almost as if they were to bid on this, they could lose a significant amount of federal funding. And I guess you can imagine if, you know, if Metro lost a significant amount of federal funding, that would really impact services, especially, I mean, just thinking about how services are impacted now with the pandemic and the driver shortage.
And I was going to say, so obviously a lot of this has to do with the driver shortage, the pandemic having an impact here. What do we know about the driver shortage and how SORTA came to this decision?
Well, the driver shortage essentially led to the end of the Metro Extra Service routes for CPS students, which, again, you had however many special bus routes specifically so students could go from a bus stop directly to a school and so on and so forth. So the pandemic basically put it into that with the driver shortage. And since then, it's been a lot of people have been protesting, have been complaining about the services that are currently provided since Metro has basically changed all their routes as a part of the Reinventing Metro plan. And that sort of led to a lot of disappointment with how, basically it was like parents had 2 weeks to prepare in order to get their kids ready to ride the bus. And since then, it's been kind of a messy situation where you have messaging from both sides, like some messaging is not coming across. Some people are saying another thing and so on and so forth. And it's just been a crazy situation. As you can imagine, writing all of this yesterday was pretty crazy as well.
I can imagine. Well, Corey, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WBXU. I'm Tamika Artis in for Michael Monks. Well, this week, President Biden signed the $1 trillion infrastructure bill into law, and the implications for our region go far beyond the Brent Spence Bridge. Joining us now to discuss this topic and much more is WVXU reporter and midday host Ann Thompson. Ann, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tamika. Thanks for having me.
And so what can you tell us about the infrastructure bill and how much money are we talking about and what projects will sort of rise to the top of the pile of many projects that need to be worked on?
That's right. So I did a story this week on how the infrastructure bill relates to smart cities. And you might wonder, what is a smart city? It's more than just a bunch of smart people living in a city, obviously. So it talks about connectivity, everything from connectivity to autonomous driving. It's when things like streetlights and EV charging ports talk to each other. So it's sensors embedded in infrastructure that are not only in infrastructure, but also in cars, an increasing amount of cars. So it's estimated that $500 million of the $1 trillion infrastructure bill will go to smart city projects. And cities are kind of scrambling to find out how much they're going to get. My story specifically focused on Ohio and how it is sort of ahead of the game in terms of this.
And that was going to be my next question for you. How is Ohio leading the way on smart city technology?
This fall, Ohio officially opened the 33 Smart Mobility Corridor, as it's called. It runs from the city of Dublin to Marysville, right past Honda's manufacturing plant. And the Transportation Research Center in East Liberty is also an integral part of the Smart Mobility Corridor. So it uses dedicated smart range radio signals to allow cars to communicate with the infrastructure. And according to Drive Ohio, which is in charge of this, the ecosystem of 33 is meant to be flexible, to be able to pivot to new technologies as they mature and the industry starts to adopt them. So it's a work in progress.
So can you talk just a little bit more about what smart technology is specifically for our city?
So it can be any number of things. Think of video streams turned into roadway monitoring devices to ease congestion. It could be sensors that gauge air pollution and promote sustainable transit alternatives. Maybe not so popular, parking sensors alerting police when somebody hasn't paid. However, I should note that there are certain restrictions in the money, the recent money for smart city projects, and it cannot involve parking tickets and stuff like that. The greater surveillance, there are organizations like the ACLU that are concerned about how those video streams can be used. But really, the applications are endless, and it's hoped that as more and more vehicles get technology that enables them to communicate with the infrastructure that will aid the driver. I should mention that as part of my story, I interviewed somebody with the company Dirk. Mm-hmm. Dirk develops algorithms to predict pedestrian and driver intent. So this is just one piece of it. So for example, their algorithms track the information for city planners. So in other words, it could be, you know, cities buy their software and are able to build a safer roundabout. Or it could be if a car had the technology that it could communicate with the infrastructure, there'd be alert, hey, watch out, this person might be crossing the road in front of you, pay attention.
And so I was going to ask you next, this could really improve pedestrian safety.
Yes. So if your car, let's say, wasn't a smart car, didn't have that technology yet, the guy with Dirk was explaining, we could make it so a light would flash on the street. Like, watch, you know, watch out or pay attention, something's happening. So this is very much an evolving situation with technology, both cars and infrastructure.
And so I think you touched on this, but let's talk more about the smart mobility corridor.
Yes. So here's what it has on it. Picture this. So 70 miles of fiber creating a redundant loop. 63 roadside units were installed, 29 connected intersections in Marysville. And I think that is the most in Ohio, and maybe I think the most in the US, 29 connected intersections. And then 16 connected vehicle intersections in Dublin, including a multi-lane roundabout. So this is only expected to grow. And this is more, apparently, according to smart infrastructure than anybody else, any other city has in the US. And they've spent, I think it was $100 million on creating this.
And so as Ohio is sort of taking the lead on this, I would imagine that other states around the country are sort of looking to us. Are we looking to anyone else in learning things from other states?
Well, really, I ask Drive Ohio, who's in charge of this, what are your goals here? Well, in addition to creating infrastructure that communicates with cars and cutting down on, you know, any pedestrian accidents, it would be to bring companies here. So there is an economic element, bring companies here to test their technology here on this smart corridor. And the hopes is we would bring them and they would stay and create jobs.
Wow. What have we learned so far? What can you tell us about that?
Well, I don't know if I can answer that, Tamika. You know, we didn't really get into, I think they're still in the stages of trying to bring companies here. In terms of what we've learned, just maybe that it is doable to have connected intersections, and hopefully this money from the infrastructure bill will enable other cities to do what suburban Columbus has done.
So when we think about the infrastructure bill, I think immediately most of us sort of think about the Brent Spence. This is really expanding the implications of the bill out of the greater region. There are a lot of areas that stand to benefit. What do we know about that, and how much money is it going to cost? We know billions of dollars, I believe, is what I heard. I don't even know how many billions, but obviously this is a big priority for this region.
Well, of course, the Brent Spence Bridge is what comes to mind. And that's certainly what Mitch McConnell was talking about when he came here. Tana, my colleague, covered that. But the infrastructure bill applies to a lot of things. For example, just this morning, I was doing an interview with the Greater Cincinnati Water Works. And there are lots of things that could be integrated when it comes to water. So I do a technology feature, and this is a feature coming up for Monday, but a technology that they are trying to develop is we don't know exactly what properties have lead water lines. And if we don't know, then the only solution is to dig up the ground and find out. Mm-hmm. And that takes a lot of time and money. So they want somebody to develop, they put out a request for proposals, somebody to develop a technology that's just kind of like a scanner. Like you scan it over the ground and there's no digging. And we, okay, this is lead or this is not lead. And they're hoping to get some of the money from the infrastructure bill. So I think a lot of the details have yet to be worked out, but there are a lot of possibilities.
I was going to say, I would imagine that a lot of people are going to try to get a piece of the pie, and someone's got to be in charge of deciding who gets what money and how much.
That's right. So time will tell.
Time will tell. All right, let's pivot and talk about another story that you covered this week. You visited some local shops. How are they preparing for holiday shopping, and what challenges are they facing when it comes to the supply chain meltdown?
So everybody's seen pictures of the large container ships on the coast and how they're stacked up with what could be people's Christmas gifts. And that is impacting shops here and shops everywhere. So I just thought I would visit a couple of them to see how they're faring and what ideas they were having. And it really seems like creativity is key. For example, King Arthur's Court is a big, well, it's a small business, but it's a large size toy store in Oakley. And a lot of people are familiar with it. And I was asking the manager buyer, Rob Kearney, about, you know, how is this going? You know, what have you noticed with any kind of COVID implications? And he said, you know, there are companies where they say, like, don't take any orders until February. And it's like, well, that's not going to work for people looking for Christmas gifts. So he just has been finding like similar things. Okay, well, if I can't get whatever, you know, some puzzle, let's say, from this company, then I will go and get it from this company. So, and then in terms of like people coming into his store, I was wondering, like, are consumers concerned about shortages? And he's telling them, like, don't panic, but don't procrastinate either. He has had people, because he said the normal Christmas shopping season begins about now, but he had people who have all their shopping done by October 1st. Hmm. So, but yeah, creativity. Then one of the other places I went is called Black Owned Outerwear, and that is downtown at the corner of 9th and Elm, mm-hmm. where Means Cameron owns a couple of places. He owns this store, and then he owns a coffee shop next door. When I went there, he was surrounded by boxes, and he had just gotten a shipment in and expected others this week, and he has enough retail to last through Black Friday. And then he'll have to restock. And he says, you know, the hardest thing right now is shipping times. He says, you know, it's taking a lot longer for things to get here. And he has to be careful, like he doesn't overpromise, mm-hmm. Overcommit, because he doesn't know how the pandemic is going to play out and what continued effect it'll have on suppliers. He is pretty confident that, yeah, I mean, it's affecting his business, but he is confident his business will continue. It's 10 years old now. He kind of, you know, knows things, even though, you know, COVID is, you know, was new, but he knows how to pivot. And just, again, creativity is key when it comes to getting the things, even though he said, you know, people wonder, like they come in the store and they say, like, hey, you don't have as much as you normally have. Okay, well, that's right. We don't have it, but this is why, and here's what I can get you.
And so I'm wondering, with the, you know, with the breakdowns in the supply chain, as we've come to know it, if some of these local shops are perhaps, you know, looking optimistically about the shopping season because people may be more encouraged to shop locally because they don't know if that certain item they want, it might arrive in the mail on time.
That's true. So for Means Cameron, the store downtown, he kind of stressed that he was also glad he had an internet presence too, because he stressed that some people still aren't comfortable coming out and shopping. I think they, you know, are confident. I'm not sure how it's going to play out. If I can bring up another story that I was just even talking about today, and I plan to do like another week or two down the road, is stores have to figure out ways to have supplies when people come in, have merchandise when they come in the store. So that might even relate to Internet of Things, again, with devices talking to one another. I'm going to be interviewing somebody next week who can explain how big box stores, let's say, can pivot to have the stock that they need, to have the workers that they need, and to have the ability for shoppers to test out things, maybe virtually, if they don't really have it in the store.
Okay.
So stores are making investments to try to make sure shoppers will be satisfied when they come in stores.
All right, Ann Thompson, thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate your time. All right, up next, we turn to our Round the Corner series, this month focusing on veterans. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.
Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU.
Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Tamika Artist. WVXU's Round the Corner series this month is focused on veterans, and reporter Jolene Amendarez brings us these stories. Jolene, thank you so much for joining us.
Of course. Thank you for having me this morning.
A fascinating series. First of all, tell us about Round the Corner.
So Round the Corner is WVXU's effort to really highlight different parts of the city that often don't get coverage or only get coverage when something bad happens. And so previously, I know Becca Costello, who's the city reporter, has done Lincoln Heights. And before that, I did Roselawn. But the idea was to highlight all 50 some odd neighborhoods in the city, plus a few other groups. It doesn't just have to be a group based on a neighborhood. So for this particular instance, we were thinking that a focus on veterans, which and we launched this before Veterans Day, would be great because they're a group that kind of gets the spotlight only during Veterans Day. And so we thought it'd be great to cover them for weeks. I've been doing that. I have two really big interviews today and a long list of stories that are still going to be coming out for the rest of this month and into December.
All right. And as we talk about veterans this month, as you mentioned, we are highlighting that. One of the stories that you covered has to do with ongoing efforts to preserve a local cemetery of Black soldiers. The other has to do with the Women's American Legion dedicated to keeping their legacy of service alive. Let's talk briefly about post-644 before we talk a little bit about that other story.
Oh, I love that. Okay. So I loved writing that story. And I sort of, somebody told me about this post in passing, and I thought, oh, maybe they might know some people who I could talk to. So I really didn't go into that thinking, oh, I'm going to write a story about this post. But once I got there, they told me it was the 75th anniversary, that it was a post that was founded by women who served in World War II. And I started talking to some of the women, and it just turned out to be such a dynamic story to tell about just the experience of women in the military. And so I really loved telling that story. And that's really how that came to be. And, you know, some of the things they talk about are how women's experiences are different. I talked to some women who were in the Women's Army Corps before the Army was desegregated and sort of what it was like after that desegregation happened and how they were treated. So it really goes in like a historical context of what it was like for these people.
And you also covered a story, a fascinating story about Hillcrest Cemetery in Anderson Township. And before we play that feature in its entirety, briefly set up the story that you uncovered there.
Right. In the Anderson Township, I mean, it's just so beautiful. You turn into this area and there are just a lot of tombstones that are kind of fallen apart, but then there are many that you can tell have been restored, and there are areas that are appear to be really well taken care of. And that's where the veterans are. It's this group of veterans who for the past few years has just been mowing the lawn, clearing out branches, restoring some of the tombstones, keeping the area clean. And these kind of efforts, you know, they take time, they take money, they take people. And we were in the middle of a pandemic as well. And so they're really just committed to, paying respect to Black soldiers who fought, I think, all the way through the Civil War. And one of the things that they talk about is how these soldiers had to fight two wars. They had to fight the nation's enemies, but then they had to fight as Black soldiers who were just not treated the same or appreciated in the same way because of their race. And so it was a fascinating story to tell. I know they're going to have some things coming up to raise money to continue to care for the cemetery. I also know there may be some funding coming through the government at some point, possibly. I understand proposed legislation to get funding for something like that hasn't been passed yet, but I know it's been proposed. And and that's happening right in our backyard here in the Cincinnati area.
And without further ado, let's go ahead and play that feature story for our listeners right now in its entirety.
Todd Mayer kneels beside a weathered headstone in Hillcrest Cemetery and pulls at some overgrown weeds.
So here's Samuel.
Samuel Robinson fought in the 54th Regiment in the Civil War, a nearly all-Black group of soldiers who famously challenged the Confederate Army at the Second Battle of Fort Wagner. It paved the way for Black soldiers to serve throughout the Union Army.
They were like top 5% of the very first Black Americans to fight in the Civil War for the Union. You know, we have one here, so we're really honored to have, you know, a glory soldier buried here amongst all these other heroes.
This is one of the three segregated cemeteries for Black soldiers in the Cincinnati area. It was in use until the 1960s and fell into disrepair. Three volunteer groups, one after the other, have taken over maintenance. Mayer's group, Friends of Hillcrest Cemetery, is a nonprofit currently maintaining it. Military service members are among rows and rows of weather-worn tombstones. Mayer says there are about 4,000 graves on the 15-acre site. More than 1,400 are military veterans.
So it's pretty significant, pretty historical. It tells the story of America, really. And I always say, you know, these guys kind of had to fight twice. They had to fight to prove themselves as soldiers because they were looked at differently as Black Americans. And then they had to go fight the country's enemies.
He's volunteered at the cemetery for years and knows a lot of the veterans' stories. He stops at the grave of Lou Jones, who served in the Spanish-American War.
Lou would have been at San Juan Hill or in Cuba next to Teddy Roosevelt, you know. And that just amazes me, you know, how close you are to greatness. First of all, I think all our soldiers are great. But, you know, here you are by the future president of the United States of America. You're fighting with him.
Next, he points out Zelman Hitchcock, a 24-year-old from North College Hill who was killed early in the Korean War.
You can picture an honor guard folding the flag, giving it to the next of kin, 21-gun salute. You know, that's the type of activity that would have happened here. I mean, it's just so picturesque. If you look out here, those are the hills of Kentucky right there. So, you know, it's still probably the same as it is as we're standing here right now that it was at the time of the funeral in March of 1951.
Mayer says roughly 15 volunteers regularly pitch in at the cemetery. They're mostly veterans like Mayer, who served active duty in the Army before becoming a reservist. He says they all feel a sense of duty to honor those who fought before them. It's not easy. A short supply of resources like money and volunteers has always hindered maintenance efforts at Hillcrest. Don Bishop is a Vietnam veteran who has been volunteering at the cemetery the longest, about 13 years.
When it was abandoned, there was no money left for maintenance. There was no money available, so we've had to raise it all. I ran a project this spring and put out 1,400 flags on Memorial Day. And to get the money for the 1,400 flags, I did a GoFundMe project.
The organization spends thousands on lawn maintenance, tree trimming, and vaults. About 2 vaults collapse every year and have to be repaired before wild animals scavenge the area. Each costs about $1,200. Keeping up with the tombstones also takes time and money because only a few chemicals are approved for use, and the organization adheres to the same standards used at Arlington National Cemetery. This is Mayor again.
You'll hear absolute horror stories about historical cemeteries where somebody thinks they're doing good and they want to come out and fix these graves, and they'll bring a power washer out and apply it to the stone. And what they do is they just erase the whole tombstone.
Mayor says the group is focused on recruiting more volunteers and finding funding to maintain the cemetery. That includes a walking tour he hopes to have ready by the spring.
As we get the word out, you know, maybe as part of it is we do a Facebook event where we come and give the tour like we just gave you.
Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown introduced legislation to create a national network of African-American burial grounds and fund maintenance efforts. It passed in the Senate at the end of 2020, but is now stuck in the House. Julian Amendadas, 91.7 WVXU.
Truly a fascinating story, Jolene, that you brought us. We really appreciate it. We know that you have many, many more stories in the pipeline. What else can we expect from this series?
Right. So the next pieces that I'm really working on, that I think at least one of them will be out next week, I think, is going to be about Lincoln Heights and some Black men who were drafted out of that neighborhood and what their experience was like. I'm also shining a spotlight on military sexual trauma and what that is like for people, and some proposed legislation that really could change the game for women in the military when it comes to sexual trauma. But there are really, so those are the two that are just about done, but the list really does go on and on. You know, I've been in touch with the VA about doing something involving PTSD. I know that I also want to do a story about the LGBTQ experience in the military, and I've done some interviews on that already. So it's really a much longer list. It's a little ambitious when you think about the fact that we're going into the holidays, but all the way through the rest of November and into December, you can expect these kinds of stories on WVXU.
Well, you certainly do have your work cut out for you, and we are excited to hear what else is in store. And our viewers can listen to and learn more about this series at WVXU.org. Jolene, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you all. Thank you all for having me on this morning.
And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer of the show is Selena Reeder. The assistant producer is Nick Swartzel. The technical director is Josh Elstro. I'm Tamika Artist. Have a great weekend.